What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And John, I think I'm going to have to give that disclaimer again, the one where I say this may be called America Trends, but we talk about things going on around the world that have an impact on these United States of America. And when you look at the Middle East, obviously we have been engaged there for so many years and in a lot of hot conflicts for about the last 20.
Yeah, oh my goodness, we've been there too long. I wonder why, you know, nobody's discussing it. What's the end game here? Because it's just crazy.
Well, we know that we have also been committed to the state of Israel since way back in the 1940s, though we weren't the leading protagonist looking to create the state of Israel. Let's understand that. That was really Britain and others, but we did certainly come along and have been now a major ally to the state of Israel. And that's why we're looking at this, because a lot of people might say, well, the reason that you've got a Middle East crisis in America is because we're always so supportive and so much interested in the future of Israel. And of course, that's what some of our Middle Eastern countries like to say. But that's not necessarily the case. We have many different interests within the Middle East. And up until this point, I think we would both say that oil has been a big part of that.
Yeah, oil is the number one game in the Middle East.
Well, not any longer. You know, we're the largest exporter of oil in the world. And I really begin to wonder at a time like this, John, where our prices in oil are going up. Why, in fact, are we still exporting as much oil when we could use it to help tamp down some of the prices?
Yeah, I don't quite understand that, what the game is there. I've been trying to figure that out because there's no real crisis around the world with oil, and our prices have been going up now. Is it a fact that maybe they want us off oil and you know, to switch to more energy-efficient vehicles?
I don't think so. I mean, that would be a good thing. But yeah. I think it's really more this concern about where are we going with Iran and whether their supply is going to be more limited or unavailable to different countries.
Okay.
So, you know, these futures markets respond to many things. And by the way, folks, we do have an incredible podcast that we've already recorded on Saudi Inc. If you've ever wanted to understand that mysterious kingdom, but that comes down the road.
Yeah,
but today we're going to talk about Israel, John, and we can't talk about America Trends without looking at Israel, its history, its future going forward, and America's relationship to it.
Yeah, well, they've been our best ally in the Middle East. So, I mean, we really depend on them, and I think they depend on us equally. So, I mean,
but do you find it curious, John, that every time we do go into the Middle East, because we don't want this imprint that the Israelis are really working with us, so we go into Iraq and we say, no, the Israelis aren't involved.
Right.
So whatever they're doing for us, and I hope Americans understand this, that they're doing many things strategically with intelligence.
Right.
I mean, they really are our handmaidens, if you will, but they are not openly involved.
No. Well, they got to be that way, though.
I know, but think about it. There are a lot of Americans, well, what good is all this foreign aid? What are they doing, you know? And they're doing many different things, but you're not going to know about many of them.
No. Well, if they did know, that would even piss these other people off more, I think.
Oh, I think you're right. But how many people really, John, understand the backstory of the state of Israel? Because the backstory brings us up to the modern day in terms of some of the grievances and some of the issues related to a two-state solution and the Palestinians. So I think it's kind of important that we give people at least some context to the state of Israel, how it was founded, what is Zionism, what were the founders intending, and where is Israel today and where it's going. Well, Michael Brenner, he's a scholar of Israel. He has a new book called In Search of Israel, and he tries to explain this unique place and go back to the roots and then forward to the changing demography. And just as we have a changing demography in the United States, Israel is really undergoing some tremendous changes. And you may not know how diverse Israel is because you hear Jewish state, but that does not typify what's really going on there.
No, I was surprised. Wait till you hear this podcast because it's very surprising what's going on.
So what we're going to do is get you up to date as to Israel, America's relationship to it, how it all started, what are the roots of some of the conflict that still goes on. And then we've got another podcast that we're going to be posting shortly that talks about how Israel may make itself almost indispensable to other nations around the world. And I think, John, if people only hear about Israel in the context of what they're doing to defend themselves and some of their conflicts with neighbors, they're missing out on an incredible story about Israel today.
No, they got some great innovation going, and they got some really good alliances going in there that's you know, it's changing the region, I think.
Absolutely. Maybe the entire world. So we'll start with In Search of Israel, Michael Brenner, The History of an Idea, today on America Trends.
Joining us is Michael Brenner. In Search of Israel is the book, The History of an Idea. And Michael, the founding story of the State of Israel, many may look back to the end of World War II, but it goes back so much farther than that. Do we need to go back to biblical times to truly understand it?
Well, I guess then I would have written 10 volumes, not one volume. Of course, if you want to understand the whole story, you can go back to biblical times. But the story of the State of Israel and its political foundation goes back about 120 years when Theodor Herzl established the Zionist movement and when the first Zionist Congress convened in 1897 in the Swiss city of Basel, and a movement was formed with the explicit goal to establish a state for the Jewish people.
And when we look back to that Zionist Congress in 1897 and the various ideas about normalizing the condition of Jewish people around the world, give us all that was at play at that convention and Herzl's ideas in particular.
So let me say a few words about this person, Theodor Herzl, who was a journalist, grew up in Hungary and Budapest, moved to Vienna with his family when he was 18 years old, and was a very respected journalist and writer in Vienna. In fact, he was the culture editor of probably the most respected German language newspaper at the time. He was part of an assimilated German-speaking family, and all he wanted to be is a Austrian Jew, Austrian citizen who happened to be Jewish, let's put it that way. But he realized there was a lot of resistance and anti-Semitism, which he kind of took for granted in his native Hungary or in Austria. But when it came to France, where he worked as a correspondent for his newspaper and witnessed the strong anti-Semitism in the country that was not only the motherland of equality of all people, but also of the emancipation of the Jews, he came to the conclusion and said, well, that's if it's possible in France, then, you know, we cannot escape anti-Semitism anywhere. And he looked for a radical solution, and his first one was very conventional. He thought all Jews should get baptized, and he described in his diary how in a solemn ceremony he would lead all the young generation of Viennese Jews into St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, until he realized anti-Semitism nowadays, meaning in the 1890s, was not really anymore about religion. It was about it was racist, and they would still see Jews even after they converted as Jews. So then he came up with the idea of founding a Jewish state, or as he called it, a state for the Jews. He was very much ridiculed by many of the established of the Jewish establishment in Europe. He said, "Why, we don't need a state? We're Austrians, we're Germans, we're French." But the masses of Jews in Eastern Europe flocked to him. Many of them did. And he realized he was able to found a movement. And you mentioned something in your question was very important. One of the basic ideas of this new movement was what they thought would normalize Jewish history. Jews were always seen as the others, the outsiders, the classical outsider. And he thought by creating a state for the Jewish people like for any other people, finally they would just be as any other people.
When you look at what he was thinking at the time, he was looking at a secular, liberal, new society that would be home to Jews and non-Jews alike, while these Eastern European Zionists advocated for the renewal of the Hebrew language and the creation of a distinct Jewish culture. Whose vision predominates in today's Israel?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There was a clash of these two visions. Herzl did not know any Hebrew. He didn't care about it. He thought in the Jewish state people would speak German, French, English. There would be French and Italian theaters and so on. There was this other group of Zionists, mainly from Eastern Europe, who thought, well, we don't only want to have our own state because of the bad guys, of the anti-Semites. We want it for positive reasons, too. We want it because we need to renew the Jewish community and Jewishness and Jewish culture. And they thought about a very central element was indeed the reinvention, in a way, of the Hebrew language and as a modern language. And it all circled around Hebrew culture. Who in the end was victorious?
Mm-hmm.
They both got a little bit. I mean, Herzl, I'm always, you know, that's a little simplified, but if you go to Tel Aviv, there's a lot of Herzl there. Herzl wanted to have a modern, flourishing, in a way, Western society, the best of Europe. He said, we'll have French opera houses, English boarding schools, and, of course, Viennese coffee houses.
But what about Jerusalem?
And if you go to Jerusalem, you have a little different picture. Now, you speak, of course, Hebrew in both places, in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So the other part of Zionism got a lot, too. But Jerusalem, of course, is much more of a, nowadays, a very a more religious place, of a place where it's not so much Herzl's vision. Herzl's very secular. So he would probably feel more at home in Tel Aviv.
You write that Israel has achieved a great deal, but, and I'll quote you, for a state widely viewed as either a paragon or a pariah, the goal of becoming a state like any other remains elusive. Explain that to us.
Yeah, let me say maybe one, let me give you an example of this idea of normalization. One of the other leaders of the Zionist movement after Herzl was Chaim Weizmann, who then became the first president of Israel. And he was a longtime leader of the Zionist movement. In the 1930s, he was at a party in Oxford. And as the philosopher Isaiah Berlin tells the story, a British lady admirer walked up to him and said, Mr. Weizmann, the Jews are such a unique people. They have all these Nobel Prize winners. They have so many achievements. And you just want a state like, and she said, Albania? And as Isaiah Berlin tells the story, Weizmann's head lit up like a light bulb, and he said, yes, we just want to be Albania. So what my Albania? Albania was just a symbol for a state nobody cares about. It's just left in peace. It's just, you know, we don't care that much. And after 2,000 years that all of these people cared so much about the Jews, that's what we want. So that's the one side. That's the story about Weizmann and a Jewish Albania. The other, though, is that Zionism also was very much about not being like any other state. And I already mentioned it about Herzl. Herzl, he wanted really to create a model state, the best society you could establish, and give set an example to other nations as well. And it also goes back to the Bible, where there is this idea of an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nation. And you can see this throughout Israeli history, that the first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, always spoke about it. He said, yes, we want to be like anybody, like everyone else, but we also want to be different, and we also want to be better in a way. And that's what I try to describe in the book, this tension between two elements of Zionism and Israel that I think were there from the beginning and are still there, and it's very difficult, basically it's impossible to reconcile the two.
Is it fair to say that Israel is still, in a sense, the Jew among nations?
I think in a certain sense this is true, and I don't mean this in a polemical sense. The idea was to normalize Jewish history and, as I said before, create a Jewish state that would just be, you know, like any other state in the world of 8 million people, like Albania, like Belize, like, you know, countries that are small and people don't care that much. That's never the case and couldn't be the case with Israel, where the major world religions have their origin, where a people lives, the Jewish people, which is so much in the eyesight of the world, for good, for better or worse. And in effect, if you look, you know, you may agree or disagree with Israeli politics. That's not, you know, my issue in the book. But it's a fact that if you look at the resolutions of the United Nations, for a while, especially in the 1980s, there were more resolutions against Israel than against all other states together. And there was something weird about it. I think most people would say, even if Israel does something wrong, it's the dimension which is wrong, the dimension of condemning one state, which is very much not in line with other states you might disagree with their policy. So in that respect, I would say Israel has not achieved that goal to be like any other state, if that was a goal.
The book is called In Search of Israel, The History of an Idea. Michael Brenner is our guest on America Trends. Is the history of Zionism and the history of Israel one and the same? Because you talk about Israel and the history of an idea, that being Zionism, and how different are they, and which has evolved more to take on the characteristics of the other? And I'm not certain, again, where people are as they're listening to this podcast and what their understanding of the development of Israel is. So help us understand the distinctions or the commonalities, Zionism and Israel.
Yeah, that's an important question. So the state of Israel was a result of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement had one major goal, to establish a state for the Jewish people. They established that goal, but they reached it at a very tragic point in history, after the Holocaust. And even Herzl and many other Zionists who were pessimistic about the future of Jewish life in Europe, they never, in their worst nightmares, would have imagined the dimension of the genocide, of the catastrophe we call the Shoah, the Holocaust today. So in 1945, we have a very different situation. And I think somebody like David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, expressed it very well when he said, for centuries, we asked the question, is there a state for the Jewish people? Will there be a state at some point for the Jewish people again? And now suddenly we have to ask the question, is there a people anymore for this state? And that was the situation after 1945, and that was also the point when actually the majority of Jews for the first time thought, yes, we should support Zionism, there should be a state for the Jews, because that's a lesson from the Holocaust, and where the majority of the world community came to the same conclusion as was shown in the UN vote of 1947 to to divide, to the partition plan to divide Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. So then Israel was founded in 1948, and now, of course, we could say the history of Zionism is over, and some people would argue so. But what was not over was the continuation of this question, how should this Jewish state look like? And that's a question that is ongoing. Jews did not have a state for 2,000 years and was far from clear, even within all the different Zionist factions, how this Jewish state would look like. Would it be, what role would religion play? Mm-hmm. Jewish religion would be secular, would be religious. How do we treat minorities? Now, for the first time, Jews are not the minority, but we have an Arab minority in that state. What do we do with that? So all of these questions and many others evolved out of the original ideas of Zionism, and they're still not answered because Israel, as many other states admittedly, but maybe more so than many others, still struggles about many of its definitions, of course, including its borders, including exactly the place religion has in the society, defining exactly the place non-Jewish citizens have in a Jewish state. All of these are ongoing debates, and if you look back, you will find many of the original discussions in the history of Zionism.
In your concluding chapter of Israel's New Order, you quote Israeli President Reuven Rivlin in 2015, stating that Israeli society is undergoing a far-reaching transformation. This is not a trivial change. It is a transformation that will restructure our very identity as Israelis. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes, I think President Rivlin gave a very important speech in which he pointed to the fact that, and that was about 2 years ago, for the first time in Israeli history, the majority of first graders are no longer in secular Jewish schools. More than 50% of Israel's young population, more than 50%, are either Orthodox Jews, and that means Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, which is two, there's a difference, of course, or they are Arab Israelis, or as many of them call themselves now, Palestinian citizens of Israel. So this kind of core population of the State of Israel during the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, which were secular, you know, more or less secular, Israeli Jews, are becoming a minority. And he pointed to these changes and the consequences for Israeli society. For example, the ultra-Orthodox Jews, I mean, not all Orthodox, but the ultra-Orthodox Jews, or Haredim, as they were called in Israel, and the Arab Israelis do not go to the army. So this is a growing population that will not be part of the army. And, you know, if you've been to Israel, you know the army is not just there to fight. The army is a very important part in Israeli society, to make connections for your future life, for jobs, and so on. So what does it mean if a smaller segment of the population joins the army? Now, of course, an increasing element among the ultra-Orthodox now also join the army, but overall, most of them don't.
The special relationship between America and Israel, is it as strong today as in the past? And explain what you think America's role is in the peace process today.
So one thing we also should keep in mind is that the strong relationship between the United States and Israel has not always been there. When Israel was founded, the U.S. was not the strongest ally of Israel. For the 50s and the early 60s, at least, France was the big ally of Israel, and especially State Department was very distant. That only really developed during the 1960s. So there was a period when the United States and Israel were not the same allies as they were now. As for the decades following, of course, Israel and the United States have been very strong allies, and Israel has been a very reliable ally in the region. I think that's important. And I would say even it didn't really matter so much if the White House was Republican or Democrat. The alliance held, and that was true in the Obama years, and that was true in the Bush years, too. You know, I'm a historian. I'd rather limit my thoughts to that. But, of course, today we are in a situation where we have two presidents, or a president and a prime minister, I should say, in Israel, who get along well. Does that mean that the Israeli U.S. relations are stronger than ever? I'm not so sure. There are a lot of rifts, a lot of tension within the American Jewish community in Israel, which are growing, especially among the younger population, and in fact among the younger population in the United States in general, the support for Israel seems to be rather declining. So I'd be cautious as if it comes to future predictions.
To many Americans, we read that Israel is our best friend in the Middle East, and yet we've been in the Middle East a lot lately, and we build these coalitions for action there, but we have to hide Israel under the cloak of not wanting to upset the Arab allies. So how does Israel maintain that level of importance? Is it intelligence, strategic awareness of the region? What do they lend to America when, in fact, we don't really openly bring them into these situations?
Well, I think, for one, Israel is a very reliable partner. It doesn't matter which government there is. Israel, of course, will always be a partner for the United States. But also, there are so many shared values, which I think is a very important factor in a long-term relationship. It is the only functioning and stable democracy in the region, and I think that is important. There are a lot of traditions, you know, not only among the Jewish population of the United States, but the Christian population of the United States that connects them with the Holy Land, with Israel. And Israel has been, of course, open in opening up the holy sites. For example, before 1967, when Jordan ruled over East Jerusalem, Jews were not allowed. Jews were not allowed to enter there, to visit their most holy place, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. So shared values, strategic importance, and reliability, I think, are very important in the long run. We're not talking about, you know, a shift 2 years from now or 4 years ago, but in a long-term relationship. And I think, you know, let's assume that Israel remains a strong democracy, and Israel has to fight to remain a strong democracy under the conditions they exist. Then I think the relation will hold, the alliance will hold.
We are going to be publishing another podcast about Israel, Thou Shalt Innovate, and there is a lot of innovation going on in Israel today, a lot of life-advancing technology and inventions that we explore in that podcast. Is there a direct link to the notion of this idea that Israel is to be a light unto nations, to this approach that they're taking to making themselves indispensable as a nation to even those who may be seen as adversaries by virtue of their technology and their inventiveness?
That's a great question, and I think you formulated it really well. So Israel is often called a startup nation because of all the startups, but also for technical innovation. And it doesn't matter if you look in IT sector or in the water development or in other areas which are somehow driven by high tech. Israel probably they of course first replied to a very pragmatic issue, namely that it is a very small country. It's so small that in most maps you can't even write the name Israel within the territory. And they don't have many, like, natural resources. Now they found gas resources offshore, but that's pretty recent. So they had to come up you couldn't just export oranges anymore in our age, as it was in the 50s and 60s, still big oranges, meaning all agricultural product. But you had to come up with something new. And they came up with what you can do with a, you know, not much territory, but a good education system and valuing education. And there are some of the best universities, certainly in the region, but also worldwide in Israel. And a certain thriving for education and innovation that led to this, what we might call the startup nation.
When we look at what we in America often digest about the state of Israel, it's relative to the conflict with the Palestinians. As an historian, how do you look at the prospects for peace? Do you think there is a possibility, given the history, of a two-state solution?
Well, I know a lot of people are very skeptical today, and they say it has passed, the two-state solution is no longer possible, or it's become so unpopular. The problem I have with this is I did not encounter a better solution. Of course, in an ideal world, there would be one state where Jews and Arabs, Jews and Palestinians, would live together peacefully without, you know, killing each other. Do I see this right now? No. I see this maybe as a long-term solution in a world where nation states will really be a matter of the past, but that's not the case today. In fact, even states where two, let's say, segments of people have lived together for quite a long time, take Belgium, take Spain, take Britain, seem to be in danger of falling apart. And I don't even have to mention Yugoslavia and the bloody conflict of people who we didn't think were as much, you know, that much enmity as we think, you know, there exists between Israelis and Palestinians. So I'm not very optimistic that a one state at this point in history, even, you know, if we wanted it, would have much chance of survival. And as for the state of Israel, the idea, and we're coming back to the idea of the book, which is the Zionist idea, was to establish a state for the Jews, which means, of course, there has to be a Jewish majority. Otherwise, it won't be a democratic state. If it's a Jewish state and a democratic state, it has to have a Jewish majority. Is this the case if Israel does not withdraw from the West Bank? Not really. If you take the whole population west of the Jordan River, including Gaza, you have a Palestinian population that comes very close to the Jewish population. And if you give everybody equal rights, as behooves a democracy, in that case, it's no longer a Jewish state. So that's a dilemma, which I think those who are in favor of a one-state solution, in my view, at least have never addressed or has never come up with a satisfying solution. So I would say yes. For now, maybe as an interim solution, I would say the two-state solution is the only viable one.
How close has Israel come to being a place where all Jews can feel it's their home?
Well, I think for an increasing segment of the world Jewish population, it is their home. That's a fact. The percentage of the Jewish population worldwide who lives in Israel is steadily increasing. When Israel was founded, only about 10% of the Jewish population, less than 10% actually, lived in Israel. Today, it's about 40% or a little more even than 40% of the Jewish population. And it is the only Jewish community in the world which clearly increases. All the other Jewish communities are either stagnant or are going back. So that's something we shouldn't forget. A larger part of the Jewish population worldwide actually lives in Israel. As for the rest, well, you know, there is not much left of the Jewish diaspora outside the United States or outside North America. There are, of course, small communities in Europe, in South America, a little bit in Australia. But we're talking mainly about American Jews. And I don't think for American Jews, Israel will be a home for the majority of them in the sense that they would move there. But a large segment of American Jews feel a strong connection to Israel. And I think there are certain, you know, that has been nurtured by programs like Birthright and other programs that bring actually young Jews and see Israel and see how and witness the society and visit, because the majority of American Jews actually have never visited Israel.
And to those who do make Aliyah to Israel from the United States, what changes in their lives most specifically?
Well, it depends. First of all, the group, if you take the whole American Jewish community, the group of American Jews, the percentage who choose to make Aliyah and live in Israel is pretty small. For those of them who are Orthodox, I think it is a feeling to live in a society where it's also, you know, very natural to be Jewish and live according to certain Jewish values. And in many respects, just also easier, unless maybe you live in New York, maybe a little exception, but any other place. So for others, I think a lot of things. You have to, if you're younger, you have to join the army. You have to live in a country where there is a certain, you know, threat of its existence in which we can't deny, and at the same time, it's also a life which depending where you go to, let's say you go to Tel Aviv, which has its sides which we don't think so much about. It's, if you live in a place like Tel Aviv or Haifa, you have a very relaxed urban Mediterranean life, and here we come back to Herzl, with coffee houses everywhere, with street life, with nightlife, very, very vibrant cities. And I think that is something which other people who are not religious are looking for. So it depends what you're looking for and who you are.
Michael Brenner, In Search of Israel, The History of an Idea. I thank you so much for sharing these thoughts with us today on America Trends.
Thank you.